I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at KUCI.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning, and welcome to this March 4th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. We are on Facebook. We are on Twitter. We are on Stitcher. I'm going to give you more information on accessing all of those later in the hour. But first, I am your co-host, your host for the hour, Marie Stone. It's my pleasure to welcome novelist John Burley and short story writer Kelly Link to the show this morning. John is with me now. Kelly will join me for the second half of the show, so stay tuned for that. John is the award-winning author of The Absence of Mercy, which won the National Black Ribbon Award, recognizing a new voice in suspense writing. He attended medical school in Chicago and completed his emergency medicine residency at the University of Maryland Medical Center and R. Adams Cowley Shock Trauma Center in Baltimore. He continues to serve as an emergency medicine physician in Northern California, where he lives with his wife, daughter, and Great Dane. But this morning, we are talking about his latest book, The Forgetting Place, and it's published by William Morrow, and we're going to talk about it this morning. John, hi.
Hi, Marie. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining me. What a great novel. What a seat-of-your-pants novel. It's fantastic.
Well, thank you. It's kind of you to say.
Yeah. So for those who haven't yet read it, I want to bring our listeners up to speed and give you a chance to talk about The Forgetting Place, kind of where it came from and the scope of the novel.
Sure, yeah. So The Forgetting Place is my second standalone novel. As you mentioned, my first novel was The Absence of Mercy that came out in November of 2013. And The Forgetting Place was just published last month. So it's a novel about a fictional psychiatric correctional facility. And the main narrator in the novel is a psychiatrist, Dr. Lee Shields. She comes in contact with a new patient that is admitted to the hospital, and she begins to be concerned that perhaps he's not there for the right reasons, that maybe he was placed there not because he's sick or psychotic, but because he witnessed a crime and needs to be kept silent. And so as she begins to investigate this situation, all of her efforts seem to be tamped down by the hospital administrators and other forces.
Where'd this idea come from? Because psychiatric institutes are so visceral and compelling and terrifying. But talk a little bit about where the seed of this novel germinated and you know, how it came about.
Sure. So, well, I should say that my wife is a psychiatrist and she works at such a facility, so that came into play. I also, during medical school, completed a six-week rotation in psychiatry in which I rotated through a very similar type institution, Elgin Mental Health Center in Illinois. And this is a very large 582-bed facility that houses patients who have been deemed either incompetent to stand trial or not guilty by reason of insanity. So spending 6 weeks there sort of puts a seed in your brain, and at some point I think that needed to come out.
That would put a seed in your brain, absolutely. You wonder if the reality, I haven't spent any time yet in a psychiatric institute, but you wonder, because we have so many images put in our heads from, you know, movies and television shows, how the reality compares to the, you know, what we see on TV.
I guess I would start by saying any day outside a psychiatric institute is probably a good day. And so if you haven't spent any time there yet, you're probably on the right track. But it's like many things in medicine. Medicine can be made very dramatic in various presentations that you'll witness it in movies and television and books. And, of course, some of the novel is possibly over-dramatized just for the sake of fiction and making a good story. But these are very compelling places to spend some time in. And while the patients are usually medicated and doing fairly well and approaching some semblance of stability, there's always a wild card there, and you're never really sure what's going to happen day to day. And patients need to be monitored closely and make sure that they're on the right track. And so it's similar to the emergency department in that when you walk into through the doors of the ER, when I do for my shifts, I never know what's coming. I never know what's going to come through the door next. And for me, that's part of the interest and the excitement. That's what keeps things fresh. And working at a psychiatric hospital has some of the same dynamics.
Right. No kidding. So let's talk about creating a compelling setting because, you know, the institute itself and even the surrounding areas in this novel are set in Washington, D.C. or so, you know, are wonderful. And avoiding cliches because it would be easy to fall into probably some cliche or overdone things of, you know, how you would describe this place. But it felt very new and fresh and uniquely described. So if you could talk a little bit about creating compelling settings, what you zeroed in on, the details you zeroed in on, and how you avoided all the pitfall traps of cliches.
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, the setting is a fictional psychiatric correctional facility on it's on the bank of the Severn River in Maryland, just a little north of Annapolis, so very close to D.C. And I sort of grew up in that area, so it's an area that's fairly familiar to me. As far as the setting is concerned, I wanted to invoke a certain mood in the story, and I think it's important when you create a setting to have that setting support the type of atmosphere that you're trying to generate in the story. And you can do that in many ways. With Menaker State Hospital, I invoked a somewhat dark, ominous tone in the psychiatric hospital. I know that that can be somewhat of a cliche, and so you have to guard against going overboard with that. But I wanted to give the hospital itself a personality that seemed to permeate the story. And there's a certain sense of paranoia within the story, and this feeling that there are things sort of looming out there that aren't necessarily something that you can reach out and touch, but you can feel them on the horizon. And so that's the sort of atmosphere that I wanted to set in The Forgetting Place.
Yeah.
As far as you know, avoiding cliches, I think that it helps to have other readers to weigh in after you've completed your first draft and to sort of point out things that maybe are cliched. I know generally what I'll do is once I finish my first draft, I'll hand it over to my wife and have her read it and have her tell me, particularly when it comes to psychiatric illness and those types of settings, where I've gotten it right and where I've sort of fallen into the pitfall of making it too much of a cliche. And on a few areas, she did point out that this is something that needs to be tweaked, and I went back and worked on it to try to make it more fresh and more original and less cliched.
Good to have a good reader, right?
Absolutely. It's critical, not only to have someone that, you know, of course, loves you and wants you to have the best novel out there that you can possibly generate, but also someone that is going to be honest with you and not necessarily spare your feelings, but you know, tell you, hey, this in this particular passage, this doesn't ring true, or you're really kind of falling into a pitfall. So not only, you know, your spouse or friend or whoever you have that is considered your trusted reader, but also your editor comes into play, and they'll go through the book and sort of discuss it with you and point out those things that need to be bolstered and those things that work well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good to have a resident psychiatrist on staff, too, I would think.
It helps. Plus, you know, it helps my own mental health as well. So she gives me free treatments.
Right, right. Isn't that great? You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is John Burley. The book is The Forgetting Place. And just to back up a little bit, your trajectory from medicine and a career in emergency medicine. Talk about your interest in fiction and how that came to be. Were you always a writer and this is just something you have been done all along, or did something compel you into writing novels?
Yeah, I think I've always been interested in writing and generating stories and ultimately novels. I was a very early reader and really enjoyed various authors growing up, and felt like, you know, this is something that I would really like to do for a living. And, you know, as you're sort of making decisions in life early on in high school and early college, trying to decide what you're going to do with your life, I definitely had this draw to creative writing. However, on the flip side, I also realized that most writers can't make a living out of it, and it's something that is very difficult to break into. And I'm somewhat of a realist, and so I realized that perhaps I should have a day job. I should have something that pays the bills and allows me to not be homeless. And so I went ahead and decided that the best thing to do would be to go into medicine, which is probably a bad choice because it takes a really long time to go through that training process. And by the time I'd finished, you know, college and medical school and residency, you're looking at 12 years down the road, and you realize, boy, I should have been writing this whole time. But once I finished residency, I had the time to sit down and try to write a novel, and so that's what I did.
Look at all the material it's giving you, though.
Exactly. It does. It does give you a plethora of material, and it's interesting, you know, to have a dream of putting a work together and writing a novel is one thing, and to actually meet it head on and attempt to do it is a whole other animal. And I think early on you have this idea that writing is going to come easy, that you've got all these great ideas, and you feel like you have some ability to build a story. But it's a lot harder than you think. And when you actually sit down and start to write, you realize, wow, this is something that I'm going to actually have to work at. And it's been a work in progress throughout. It's a humbling experience, because I think what happens is that you tend to, you know, write a chapter, and you get to the end of that chapter, the end of the day, and you feel like you're pretty happy with how the chapter ended up, and you're happy with your work that day. And so you go and you take a break, and you come back to it the next day, and you sort of read what you've written, and you realize, wow, I've got a lot of work to do on this chapter. So it's something that always requires revision, always requires more work, and that way it's an interesting endeavor.
Yeah, yeah. Talk a little bit about time management, because, you know, both you and your wife have aggressive careers. You're a dad and you're a novelist. So talk about fitting the novel in. You know, do you work every day on it, and kind of, you know, the logistics of writing a novel when you're very, very busy.
Right. It's difficult. And I think that like anything that you love, you fit it in because you want to fit it in. And if it's a chore, if it's something that's just you know, something that you're not looking forward to, then you're probably not going to make the time to write. But I really enjoy the process, and so I do it whenever I can. A lot of times that tends to be on days that I have off during the week. I work in an emergency department, so our shifts vary, and I get scheduled for a certain number of shifts, including nights and weekends and so forth. But that also means that I do get random Tuesdays or Thursdays off, and find myself at home with just me and the dog, and that's a great time to write, because it's really helpful to have that quiet to sit down and work on a story. It's hard for me to try to put together a chapter after the end of the day, after my shift, because the shifts are long and exhausting and emotionally draining, and you kind of get home and just don't have that same reserve to put into your writing. So I try to write on days that I'm not scheduled to work.
Yeah, right. Let's talk a little bit about managing suspense, which is another thing you do fantastically well. So writing a psychological thriller, you have to drop hints to your readers of what's coming next. You have to keep them interested. You have to have kind of little mini cliffhangers at the end of chapters. All of that you manage so well. So if you can talk a little bit about managing suspense through the course of the novel, whether you're a big outliner so you know when to drop hints, kind of, you know, how you keep the reader on the hook.
Right. So I'm definitely not an outliner, and that's something that can be problematic, because you can certainly write yourself into corners and have to figure out how you're going to get out. But for me, that's part of the fun of sort of keeping it fresh and not knowing exactly how the story is going to go. So what I do is I'll start out with an initial scene, initial characters, and I know ultimately where those characters are going to end up. And so just connecting point A and point B is the whole exercise of writing the novel. And I try to keep it fluid. I try to write what comes into my head, and I'm trying to direct the characters in some way. But you'll find find that if you're laying too heavy a hand on the characters, they won't behave in the way that you want them to, or the writing will sound forced. And so I think you have to just have faith that the characters that you've created are going to have their own voice and make their own decisions. And some of those decisions are going to surprise you. But I think at the same time, that's what keeps the writing fresh and interesting. As far as building suspense, I think you have to keep in mind the tone and the atmosphere that you want to maintain in the story, and make sure that you're serving that, and make sure you're plotting well, and make sure that you're keeping up a good pace, because those are things that people tend to get sort of bogged down on, is they put in too much detail, or their pace starts to slip, and then they start to lose that atmospheric tone to the novel.
Right. Yeah, one of the things that I've heard some thriller writers do is they write it all the way through, and then they kind of back outline. So they see this whole scope and course of the novel, and then they outline what they've got, so they can kind of see where the holes are. I don't know if your revision process looks like that at all, or how you revise it.
I think that revision is key. And certainly when you write a first draft, it's very rough. And I try to pay attention to detail during the creation of the first draft, but I know that when I go back and start working on it, there's a lot of things that I'm going to need to flesh out. There's connections that need to be made, and things that probably needed to be edited out, because not everything is going to serve the story. And so generally, I will write through a first draft, and once I have that, then I'll go over it with my editor. She'll point out things that she thinks need to be worked on, and I, of course, have my own things that I like to work on. And so then we really set to work on fleshing the story out, making sure the characters are vivid, and making connections. And so that's sort of my work progress.
Nice. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is John Burley. The book is The Forgetting Place. I want to give you a chance to read to us, but before we do that, let's do a little bit on character, mining character. This book was written largely from a woman's point of view, so I wanted to get your thoughts on writing, whether it's easier or more difficult to write from the opposite sex point of view, and kind of how your process of getting to know these people.
Sure. Well, I, whenever you're trying to write from a certain point of view, it's critical that you sort of take yourself out of that picture and put yourself into the shoes of the narrator or the person whose point of view you're trying to get across. And so when I'm writing about Lise, I'm, you know, of course, putting myself into her shoes and trying to see things through her perspective. And that's really the only way to go when you're trying to present character. As far as writing in an opposite gender, it does have its challenges, and I enjoy it because I think it makes things fresh and interesting. And I'm not going to get it 100% right because I'm a guy writing in a female voice. And the key again is having someone that can come back to you and say, a woman wouldn't say this, or a woman wouldn't see things this way, and then you can go back and you can tweak it as needed. But the initial process, I think, it was fun writing her in her voice.
Were there characters in here that gave you a particularly difficult time that you had more trouble accessing than other characters?
I had a little trouble accessing her patient, Jason, and that's because I think that we get very limited information from Jason early in the novel, and you're sort of given information as things go along, but he's a little guarded, and I had a little difficulty making him likable and someone that the reader could connect with, and yet, you know, doing justice to the fact that he maintains his guard during the course of the novel and sort of holds Lise at bay a bit, and so that's a fine line that you have to walk. You have to make sure that you're doing justice to who the character is. At the same time, you need the reader to connect with them.
Right. So let's give you a little chance to read to us.
Sure. I'd like to just start with the first chapter, and I'm going to just read an excerpt from the first chapter. This is the way that we open the novel, and Lise is telling us a little bit about Menaker State Hospital, what kind of place it is, and what kind of emotion and atmosphere it elicits. So, Menaker State Hospital is a curse, a refuge, a place of imprisonment, a necessity, a nightmare, a salvation. Originally, funded by a philanthropic endowment, the regional psychiatric facility's sprawling, oak-studded campus sits atop a bluff on the eastern bank of the Severn River. From the steps of the hospital's main administration building, the outline of the U.S. Naval Academy can be seen where the river enters the Chesapeake Bay, some 2.5 miles to the south. There is but one entrance to the facility, and the campus perimeter is demarcated by a wrought iron fence, whose 10-foot spear pickets curve inward at the top. The hospital is not a large central structure, as one might imagine, but rather an assortment of red brick buildings erected at the end of the 19th century and disseminated in small clusters across the quiet grounds, as if reflecting the scattered, huddled psyches of the patients themselves. There is a mild sense of neglect to the property. The wooden door frames sag like the spine of an old mare that has been expected to carry too much weight for far too many years. The diligent work of the groundskeeper is no match for the irrepressible thistles that erupt from the earth during the warmer months and lay their barbed tendrils against the base of the edifices, attempting to claim them as their own. The metal railings along the outdoor walkways harbor minute, jagged irregularities on their surfaces that will cut you if you run your fingers along them too quickly. The word asylum has long since fallen into disfavor to describe institutions such as this. It conjures up images of patients. There was a time when they were once referred to as lunatics. Shackled to concrete slabs and small, dingy cells, straining at their chains and cackling madly into the darkness. To admit that we once treated those with mental illness in such a way makes all humanity cringe. And therefore, one will no longer find asylums for such individuals, but rather hospitals. And yet, for places like Menacher, I've always preferred the original term. For although we attempt to treat the chronically impaired, much of what we offer here is protection, an asylum from the outside world.
That's great. That was John Burley reading from his latest novel, The Forgetting Place. Let's talk a little bit about minor characters. I should have asked this earlier when we were talking about characters, but there are a lot of minor characters in here who are nonetheless important. I mean, Lisa's parents, you know, obviously played a role in how she sees the world, how she grew up. Amir, kind of major, minor character. I don't know how you categorize some of the men in the novel, but how much do you as author feel it's important to flesh out completely all of the minor characters, and at what level of, you know, you really have to have Lise fleshed out, you really have to have Jason pretty fleshed out, at what level does that fall away for some of the minor characters? How well did you feel you needed to know Lise's parents, for example, or some of the other characters?
Well, I think that much of what makes Lise who she is comes from her childhood experiences, like all of us. And so I thought it was important to flesh out her parents on some level, that these are people that were paramount in her life, especially during her earlier years, and they played a big role in shaping her. So I thought it was important to flesh out her mother and her father, and of course her uncle that she comes in contact with. And so these characters were important. On the other hand, they're only as important as they serve the story. And so you want to flesh out characters to the point that they serve the story well, but not go beyond that so that you're just talking about things that don't necessarily drive the story forward or help to identify what you're getting at underneath. And so that's kind of how I approach minor character development, is to keep in mind that you want to make these people real, but you don't want them to take over the story.
That's what I love. That's what's difficult for me, is getting caught up in either, you know, setting descriptions or other character descriptions and getting off on tangents. And I think if you stick to the plot, I mean, this is a very plot-driven novel. So if you stick to, you know, getting from point A to point B with just as much as necessary to do it, it really moves the story and drives it really well.
It depends on what type of novel you're writing. You know, if you're writing something that is sort of ethereal and very literary and something that sort of waxes philosophical, then you have more latitude in sort of going off on tangents. But if you're writing a thriller or a dark psychological suspense novel, then you want a plot-driven story. You want the story to continue to move, and that's something that, you know, we work on during the course of the novel. There's more to a novel than actually makes the page, and there's various things that will eventually get cut from the novel because they're not serving the plot, they're not driving the story forward, and making those decisions is difficult as a writer because you tend to become married to everything that you put on the page and feel that it's important. But when you look at it objectively, you really have to, especially going back and doing the rewrites, you have to sort of take off your writer's hat and be more objective and ask yourself, does this serve the story? Is this moving the plot forward? And if not, as pretty as it is, it probably needs to go.
Yeah. Ain't that true? So much ends up on the cutting room floor. And it's so right. Hard to do that. Yeah.
It is. It's painful.
It's painful. You are listening to Writers on Writing. My guest is John Burley. We're wrapping up our half hour together, but I wanted to give you a chance to give writing advice, what you've garnered along the way in your novel process, what's coming up next for you, and what our listeners who are largely writers should be thinking about in their own writing.
Well, I think, you know, there's several key things in being a writer, and you know, one of the most important thing is to read and make sure that you're reading widely and not just within the genre that you're interested in writing about, that you can pick up all kinds of things by reading other people's work and find things that people do really well and hopefully incorporate into your own writing, and also identify things that are done badly and try to stay away from those things. So reading is critical, and also it seems obvious, but writing is critical. There are a lot of people who really want to be writers and never really get into the whole writing process. And so I think it's important to spend the time in front of your computer or your typewriter or your sketch pad and make sure that you're actually putting in the hours to allow those creative juices to flow. Because if you don't sit down and spend time with your work, then you're not going to move it forward. It's also something that obviously you should love, because writing is hard work. It's not immediately gratifying in terms of financial gain or having a fast-paced career. It's going to take a lot of work, and there are going to be a lot of rejections, and there's going to be a lot of ups and downs. And so if it's not something that you love, there's much easier ways to make a living. And so do yourself a favor and find one of those other avenues. But it's something that I really enjoy. I would do it even if I was just writing stories for myself. And so I think that's probably the right way to approach it.
Yeah. What was, without giving anything plot-wise away from this book, was there a big surprise, either plot-wise or for you as a writer-wise, what came out of this project for you?
I think for me, one of the surprising relationships in the book was between Lisa and her uncle. Mm-hmm. That was something that wasn't written into the first draft, which ends up, to me, in my mind, being a very crucial relationship and drives the plot in many ways. And so that relationship and what came of it was surprising and original when we went back and worked on the rewrite.
That'd be fun to go back to a book that you feel like you already know really well, and then to have revelations for yourself as writer. You know, that's great.
Absolutely. I mean, a novel and a story is very dynamic, and I think one pitfall you can fall into is to sort of lose the vision that your story is malleable. And when you put words on a page, they can always be edited. They can always be worked on. And, the story can go in a different direction or a new direction. And so having the ability to see that a story is fluid, I think is really helpful when you go back and do the rewrites.
Yeah. We can find you online.
You can. Right. I'm my website is www.john-burley, B-U-R-L-E-Y, forgettingplace.com. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter, and my email contact is on my website. So if you have any questions or comments, I love to receive emails, and I'm happy to answer all the emails that I get.
Fantastic. John Burley, thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
That was John Burley. The book is The Forgetting Place. It is out and available now, and it is a cannot-put-down read. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Kelly Link will be with me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. We are on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads. We are on Facebook, Writers on Writing KUCI. We are on Twitter. We are on Stitcher. There is no reason not to listen to us at home, in your car, or on an airplane. We're available all the time. And I just want to give a quick shout out to some of the other public affairs programs available on KUCI. We have so many of them. We have a great food show. We have a great film show. So if you are a longtime listener of Writers on Writing, tune your dial into some of these other shows, too, because there's a lot of great stuff on KUCI. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. I'm on now with Kelly Link. Kelly is the author of the collections Get in Trouble, Stranger Things Happen, Magic for Beginners, and Pretty Monsters. She is the co-founder of Small Beer Press. Her short stories have been published in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, the Best American Short Stories, and Prize Stories, the O. Henry Awards. She has received a grant from the National Endowment of the Arts. She is from Florida and currently lives in Northampton, Massachusetts. Kelly, welcome.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I am a huge, as anybody who listens to the show knows, I am a huge lover of short stories. So anytime I get a new short story collection in my hand, I'm an excited person. So this was a treat. And I haven't read a lot of short stories in the sort of fantastical genre. So this was really great. I'm going to give you a chance to introduce the collection. Get in Trouble is what we're talking about this morning, and sort of how it departs and how it relates to the other collections that you've put out.
I only seem to write stories which have some kind of surreal or fantastic element in them. This is my fourth collection, three for adults and one for young adults. And I think the stories in this, they're ghost stories. They're stories about people sort of acting impulsively. There are some superheroes in it. You know, it's actually pretty much the same kind of stuff that I've enjoyed writing about since the beginning.
Right. And tell me a little bit about the germs of the idea for the short stories. Where are they? Where they come from? If they all begin sort of plot based? If they begin with a character? If it's, you know, kind of all different? But tell me a little bit about how a story germinates with you originally.
Well, I think there are probably more than two kinds of writers, but there are writers who have ideas and sort of can't wait to sit down and start teasing out those ideas, and then there are writers who would rather do anything else and have to be sort of dragged to a flat surface with a computer, some paper on it, and I have to be dragged. The way it used to work for me is I was in an MFA program, I went to workshops, and so I had deadlines to write for, and now the way it works is that I have editors, and so the editors will say, I'm putting together an anthology, or we're doing this kind of issue for a magazine. Do you have any ideas that would suit this theme? Mm-hmm. So usually the starting place for the story now is somebody saying, it would be great if you wrote a story. And since I don't actually necessarily enjoy writing, or at least not the initial phase of it, that's how I get started.
I like that. That would be much better. Be much easier. Why don't you just tell me what to write?
I guess it really helps to be told that you should do something. It would be nice to be a self-starter, and I am on occasion. I have a writers group up here, and we meet and work together on a regular basis. And so once I know that I have a deadline for something, the ideas sort of collect or adhere around, oftentimes around something that we've been talking about in writers group, whether it's tropes of vampire stories or whether it's certain kind of character dynamics that we've been talking about.
I like it. You have said in the past that you have a lot less patience these days for stories where the writer seems to feel some sort of contempt or distaste for the characters of their stories or for their audience. And I was trying to think of examples where I felt like writers had contempt for their subjects. But I wanted you to talk a little bit about characters who may give you difficulty, who you may originally not all characters are likable, especially the interesting ones aren't all likable, and finding empathy and tenderness for difficult characters and sort of how you go about that.
Sure. Well, I can flip that on its head and say that what I really like when I read is a feeling of generosity or sort of expansiveness, so that I feel that, the book or the short story that the writer identifies with the character and understands the reasons that their characters might do the things that they're doing, rather than, in some ways it's kind of an old-fashioned storytelling where you have people who, or maybe it's an old-fashioned kind of storytelling for children or young adults especially, where the characters in the story behave badly and are punished for it. I really like the kind of story in which you don't necessarily have to see characters redeemed, but I do want the sense that I'm in the same boat as the writer, that I want to like the people in this story.
Were there characters in this collection who you related to better than, who clicked with you, would you say?
Well, that's a good question. No, I think that part of writing a story, if the story is in any way pleasurable to work on, or if you are satisfied by the end of writing the story, you have to have found a way into those characters' heads. So you have to find points of identification. There are a bunch of adolescent girls in these stories, and there are some middle-aged people. And I'm middle-aged now. I suppose I should feel more sympathy for the middle-aged characters, but I'd say I feel a little bit less. I actually still, when I'm writing the teenaged characters, that those are the ones that I feel the most tenderness towards.
Because it's such a tender age, right?
Even if something happens in the story, it's terrible that, they're gonna find their way out of it.
Right, right. Yeah, adolescence is such a visceral age. I mean, I can't think of a better age to write about angst and horror, really.
Absolutely. Also really
adolescence
funny stuff,
is horror.
Which may not seem funny to the characters at the time, but,
Right.
It's nevertheless funny.
Yeah, right, right. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, Writers on Writing. My guest this morning is Kelly Link. The collection is Get in Trouble. As I mentioned, I'm drawn and write short stories, and I haven't tried my hand at a novel. And I don't think you don't write novels either.
I have not written a novel. I am due to write a novel. I sold a novel, which I have not written, but I guess I will have to write it. As I said, it's good to have a deadline and an editor.
Right, right. But I always love to talk to short story writers about what it is they feel. There's such an difficult to put your finger on quality to short stories. Their endings are always kind of, off and weird and not tied up in a nice bow as novels are. Their characters are often a little bit quirky or a little bit more unknown to to the readers, a little more inaccessible. So talk about what you think makes a short story successful, if there are elements of short stories that you think are crucial to making a short story work as opposed to a novel. And, you know, well, I'll get to the other questions in a minute. I'll let you start there.
Sure. You know, I think that for one thing, the audience for short stories is a little bit smaller than the audience for novels. So you're already working for a group that has kind of self-selected itself and is maybe willing to go along with the things that short stories do well. And the other half of that is that because short stories are going to come in somewhere under 20,000 words, you know, the classic length for a short story is between maybe 4,000 and 7,000 words, maybe the readership has a little bit more patience for not having things explained right away, or maybe at all. It's easier to sustain a certain kind of mood for the length of the entire story. I think you can be a little trickier in terms of point of view or experimental, and you can do all of these things in a novel. It's just that it's harder to sustain at a longer distance. You know, longer length. And I think short stories, I think one of the things that works best in a short story is ghost stories. That ghost stories are sort of suited to that sort of shorter narrative, harder to pull off, although it's possible, a really sustained, scary piece of storytelling at novel length.
Right. Yeah.
I love ghost stories, so...
Somebody had described your style of short story in that regard, or sort of the setting, as nighttime logic. And the more I think about that phrase, the more I'm totally totally loving it. But they are. It's nighttime logic. It's dream logic. It doesn't. You start to describe a dream, and it doesn't make sense to anybody but you. But you feel like something in there is really true or resonant. And that's how these stories are. They apply nighttime logic. Had you thought of that term? Because it's really great. Or did somebody come up and apply that to your work?
That's the term. I think the first time I heard it, a writer named Howard Waldrop, who's mostly a short story writer, was using it to describe the difference between what he thought of as two different kinds of stories, daytime logic stories and nighttime logic stories. And, you know, the daytime logic story, everything that's going on in it sort of correlates to the real world. Even maybe the feel of the sentences have a sort of everyday rhythm to it. And I think nighttime logic stories, and again, I'm sort of going off of what he says, and I hope I'm still in the ballpark that he was in, nighttime logic stories. You may not entirely understand what's going on in the story, and in fact, the writer may not either, but there's a kind of coherence there that does not necessarily match up to the real world, even if it feels true in some way. I think fairy tales have a kind of nighttime logic to them. I think love stories maybe have a kind of nighttime logic to them. Mm. You know, it's sort of an increased intensity of feeling. Maybe the rules feel slightly different. And I don't think it's limited to work which has a surreal feeling or which is fantasy. I think there are examples of short stories that are not necessarily fantastic, but there's sort of a troubling feeling to them. There's a feeling that what's going on may be true, but it pokes at you. And I'm thinking of maybe more experimental short story writers. Or even novels. So Ben Marcus's collection, for example, some of the stories about nothing that happens in them, you know, couldn't happen in the real world, and yet you feel like the world of the story is maybe a couple of doors away from the world that we live in.
Right. I guess that it sort of dovetails on that is that you've been called the master of the unsaid, and I think maybe a lot of short story writers are the masters of the unsaid. But I was wondering how conscious that is in your writing process, that maybe you overwrite and then you take things out that you feel are too over-explanatory, or are you just kind of naturally the master of the unstated?
I don't know. The only thing I can say is that I don't tend to do a lot of cutting. I tend to err on the other side and have to go back in and figure out what I have to put into a story. And, you know, I think that this is something that is especially true of short stories, as you said, is all the stuff that you have to leave out. You know, there's just not space for it. And so for me, the tension with a short story is how do I cram as much stuff into it as possible how do I make the short story feel expansive? What are the things that maybe feel a little bit digressive on the surface, even if I feel that they have to be there, but feels like maybe a little bit of extra icing or something, as opposed to what is the stuff that I don't have to put in the story because I'm going to trust that the reader will be able to supply it, or else that I'm going to supply something else that will substitute for answers. You know, can I make the story have enough emotional weight that maybe the answers to the questions that I've raised aren't the point? You know, I kind of feel as a writer that my job is not to give answers. It's to allow space for a reader to ask questions and maybe come up with their own answers.
I like that. My guest this morning is Kelly Link. The collection is Get in Trouble. I have a couple of completely self-serving questions because there are things that I struggle with that I love to get other writers' point of view on. One is titles. I think titles of short stories are very difficult. And talk about that, about coming up with the right resonant title. I think a novelist has it easy because they only have to come up with one, but short story writers have to come up with like 12. Talk a little bit about titling short stories.
Sure. You know, I actually always, this is one of the things about writing a novel that just seems like no fun to me, which is that you only get one title. Because I think coming up with titles can be enormously pleasurable. And, you know, the way that I come up with titles is the same way that I come up with figuring out what kinds of things I'm going to put in a story. And that's just to give myself a lot of opportunity to play, to sort of goof, so that, you know, when I'm thinking about a story, I come up with titles that maybe are really dumb, or titles that are, you know, puns, or titles that you know, aren't going to work at all, but they sound pretty. So part of it is just thinking about what sounds nice, what has a nice sort of assonance or flow. Part of it is sort of trying to put my finger on whatever it is that feels to me is in the story that maybe I can't pull out in any other way. And part of it is riffing off of other people's titles, you know, that I always have in the back of my head a list of some of my favorite short story titles. And I think, well, I want a title like that. You know, what can I come up with that will have feel of a title that I really love?
One thing that's sort of unusual is that often short story writers will take the collection, the title of the collection, out of a title of one of the short stories, and you don't do that, which I kind of liked, that you looked over the 7 or 8 or 9 stories in here and then extracted out a whole new title to unite them together.
I've done it a couple of, you know, different ways. So the first collection that I published was called Stranger Things Happen. And that is not actually a title from any of the stories. I think it's a subtitle for one of the stories. But it just seemed to suggest something that would suggest the book itself. And so the second collection was called Magic for Beginners. And that was a cheat in a kind of way because I came up with the title for the collection before I came up with the title for the story that ended up being called Magic for Beginners. I thought this would be a fun name for a collection. I had a story that I was working on. I thought it would probably also work for this. And it was a very long story. It was kind of going to be the anchor of the collection. So I thought, well, this seems like it'll work for both. And then for this one, I didn't really love any of the individual titles of the stories to sort of suggest the feel of the book. But when I was going through it, it did seem to me to be an accurate title in terms of what was going on with all of the characters. And all of the characters were pretty much either troublemakers or else people who were pretty impulsive. And I think and the more I thought about it, the more it seemed to me that you know, the one of the basic strategies of the short story or of stories at all is characters doing things that they shouldn't do.
Right. Sadly, we've drawn down on our time and we didn't even get to talk about your press. I wanted to talk about Small Beer Press and publishing houses and the state of all of that. So I have to have you back on to talk about all of that.
Oh, I'd love to.
I'm sorry.
Well, thank you. No.
Tell us where we can find you online, find out more about you, and find out more about Small Beer Press.
Yes, smallbeerpress.com and kellylink.net, and I am on Twitter.
Good. Are you a Facebook person?
I am not. I really like Twitter. Facebook seems like I don't like the interface.
You know why? Because you're a short story writer, and short stories are more conducive to Twitter than the expansive world of Facebook, right?
I think you're probably right. Absolutely.
Any last minute words of advice before you leave us?
Find a group of people and try writing with them. I really love meeting up with my group of friends and all writing together. It is liberating.
I like that. Kelly Link, thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
That was Kelly Link. The collection is Get in Trouble. That's all the time we have for today. I wanted to mention that we have an intern in studio. KUCI opens up once a year to community members and all year long to UCI students to do a radio show here if you are so interested. And the interns are in now. Valentina is my intern. Hi. Thanks for doing this.
And thanks for having me.
Oh, are you going to, why don't you take us out on a legal ID and tell us anything you want to tell us about yourself in the last minute?
Okay, I just give you the legal ID, and you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 in Irvine.
That's perfect. That's all the time we have for today. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. Tune in to us. Tune in to other KUCI public affairs shows, and we'll see you next week. Thanks.